From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made in 16 days. October 17th is the day that Canada will make recreational cannabis legal. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has said that this progressive marijuana policy replaces the old failed model that made criminals rich. It's a huge change with the potential to have many ripple effects. And there are plenty of unanswered questions still. We've heard from Connections listeners who are already wondering what will happen to Americans who travel to Canada, use marijuana, then attempt to cross the border back to the United States. What questions might be asked? What are the possible consequences? Now, what about Canadians who want to come here, to Rochester or elsewhere, and they admit to border agents that they use marijuana? Politico reports on the confusion, saying that they can be denied admission in a way that would be less rigorous than a court of law. And what about people who work in the growing industry for medicinal cannabis here in the United States and in Canada? Well, the Office of U.S. Customs and Border Protection recently issued an alert reminding travelers from Canada that marijuana remains illegal in the United States. Our guests are going to try to answer all of your questions and more this hour, and I want to welcome them now. Danielle Rizzo is a senior counsel with Harris Beach, came into Rochester from Buffalo this afternoon. She's focusing on immigration and nationality law and employment-based immigration. Very active in the American Immigration Lawyers Association, including serving as the immediate past chair of the AILA's Customs and Border Patrol Liaison Committee. Did I get it all right?
Yes, except it's U.S. Customs and Border Protection.
Protection.
Yes.
Okay, see, I knew there was somewhere in there. Thanks for coming in from Buffalo, and I know that this is a busy time, not just with this, but with news that's coming from the White House this morning that there's been sort of, in the president's word, a repeal and replace for NAFTA,
yes,
which could impact you or no, you think?
NAFTA is primarily a trade deal, but there is one schedule that deals with immigration. NAFTA is what created what's known as the TN visa, which allows Canadian and Mexican citizens and U.S. citizens, it's a trilateral agreement, to go back and forth if they are a member of one of about 60 professions. And so from what I'm reading so far, and I have not yet had a chance to read the entire New Deal yet, but
it's like hours old. Yeah.
Yeah. But the immigration provisions have not significantly been changed. The trade provisions have, though.
Okay. Well, I know you're busy enough with this regarding questions at the border and many other arenas, including legalization of marijuana in Canada. So, Danielle, thanks for being here. Appreciate that. Jeremy Unruh is on the line with us. He's Director of Regulatory Affairs for PharmaCann LLC. Jeremy, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm just fine. Delighted to be on your program. Thank you so much.
And Jeremy, why don't you let our listeners know what PharmaCann is and where you operate?
Sure. So we are one of the registered organizations, one of the medical cannabis licensees in New York State. And so we operate a cultivation center in Orange County, and we operate four dispensaries across the state in the Buffalo area, Syracuse, Albany, and then down in the Bronx. We are a multi-state operator, so we also operate, and when I say operate, I mean cultivate and dispense medical cannabis in Illinois, in Massachusetts, and then we're developing in Maryland, and we're developing sites in Ohio and Pennsylvania as well.
Okay. I want to listen, if we could, to what the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, said about this. Now, there was a lot of expectation, from what I'm reading in various sources, that this would have happened actually a little bit earlier during the summer, but we're about a couple weeks away from full legalization in Canada. And here is Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau talking about that.
Parliament has now passed Bill C-45, which will legalize and strictly regulate access to cannabis. We will soon have a new system in place, one that keeps cannabis out of the hands of our kids and keeps profits away from organized crime. Today, I'm also pleased to announce that the new recreational cannabis regime will officially come into force on October 17th of this year. We heard from provinces and territories who told us they needed more time to transition to this new framework. So our government will continue to work in full partnership with them to ensure the smooth and orderly implementation of this new law across Canada.
October 17th is happening. Jeremy, what stands out to you first and foremost, either a concern or otherwise, about this announcement from Canada?
Well, I think from an industry perspective, it's all positive, because what it does is it just gives some structure to these winds that are pushing in the direction of responsible legalization of cannabis for both medical and adult use purposes. So I think that at the 10,000 foot view, these are positive. Now, I also am aware that the Canadian adult use program is not simply the kind of adult use program that we see in the Western United States. It's more geared towards harm reduction, and it's my understanding, and I'm not granular on the Canadian adult use law, but it's my understanding that it has that they devolve a tremendous amount of regulatory authority to the various provinces to create a program that is right for Ontario, to create a program that's right for Saskatchewan, to create a program that's right for British Columbia. So I don't think that each of the provinces' programs are going to look exactly the same. And so I think that there's some issue there working out what each province's program is going to look like. But all in all, these are positive wins.
As we go throughout this hour, Danielle Rizzo is really here to lend her expertise and her understanding of not only what the law says, but the questions that could come up. We already have a number of questions from listeners that have come in via email. You can email the program if you like, connections@wxxi.org. You can call 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Jeremy, before we kind of get into some of those granular questions step-by-step on what this does mean, I'm curious to know if you think that this is a harbinger of anything when it comes to public opinion, the way populations view marijuana usage, medicinal and recreational, and if you think that this moves the United States any closer to legalization.
You're talking about the Canadian movement.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, it's just another headline, another country that's fully legalizing, and I wonder if you think it has any impact here.
I think it does. I think both from a from just the perspective of seeing headlines coming out of our neighbor to the north legalizing cannabis, I think that does a lot to inuring our population to the possibilities of legalization. But more importantly, what I think it does, particularly for the business community and the economic development stakeholders in our country, whether they're private actors like myself or government actors or what have you, is what's happening is there's a tremendous amount of economic opportunity that's being lost to Canada. There are companies in the United States, medical cannabis companies and adult use cannabis companies, that are getting bigger and more robust. They're turning into real live multi-state companies, and the fact that there is this in the United States federal illegality in clarity, this tension between 30 some odd states that want either a medical or adult use program and the federal government that hasn't really caught up to that yet, it's making it hard for us to compete with the Canadians. Remember, Canada is a country with some 35 million people. So while these Canadian medical and adult use marijuana companies are getting bigger and robust and building out their facilities and building out their teams and investing in this, the development of this industry, we're still crippled by this tension between the states and the federal government. And so I think it has the Canadian announcements have a positive impact in getting people to understand that if we're going to be competitive in this brand new emerging market, that we need to do something at the federal level here in the United States.
Yeah, I'm going to turn to Danielle with the questions on lack of clarity in just a moment. Let me go ahead and read from the Government of Canada laying out on their own website how the new Canadian law works. Upon coming into force, adults in Canada will be legally allowed to purchase fresh or dried cannabis, cannabis oil, plants, and seeds for cultivation from either a provincially or territorially regulated retailer, or where this option is not available, directly from a federally licensed producer. They will be allowed to possess up to 30 grams of dried legal cannabis or its equivalent in public. They will be allowed to share up to 30 grams or its equivalent of legal cannabis and legal cannabis products with other adults. They will be allowed to cultivate up to 4 plants at home, 4 plants total per household, and allowed to prepare varying types of cannabis products, such as edibles, at home for personal use, provided that no dangerous organic solvents are used in the process. So that's what's coming in Canada. on October 17th. And I think a good place to start with questions for Daniel Rizzo comes from an email from Justin, who is presumably not Justin Trudeau, but Justin is, because he says, as an American citizen, I'm wondering what this means for anyone who goes to Canada, partakes in marijuana, then returns home. Will we get searched at the border? Will we get drug tested at the border? Daniel.
So U.S. citizens who are returning home from Canada cannot be refused entry to the United States. You have a right to return to your home country, however, which is a concern for Canadian citizens. But for U.S. citizens, if you are carrying any marijuana on your person or in your vehicle, that can be searched and seized. There are still criminal law consequences to that. If you are found to be in possession of marijuana at the border, they will call the police, and so you can still be arrested for that because it is against the law. So those are concerns. Are they going to ask every single person coming across the border if they partook in marijuana? Probably not. I don't think there's any widespread movement to do that. However, you know, if it does come up, you can't lie in response to any officer's questions. So if an officer asks, then you do have to be truthful about it. But it is not illegal to use it in Canada. It's just illegal to bring it back across the border. And also, if you're still under the influence of marijuana when you're driving your vehicle, that's also a criminal offense.
All right, so there you go. And I think to Justin, the emailer's point, he is, it seems to me, wondering if they ask you, have you used, and you say yes, are you opening yourself up in any way to any further action? In other words, if they say, are you high right now? Or I mean, I think he's kind of wondering, what are they allowed to ask you? What's going to happen?
They can ask if you're still under the influence at that time. They can ask, they can search cars. They have authority to do that absent any suspicion of wrongdoing. So definitely it could lead to a car being searched. But it's if they're not carrying anything across the border and they're not under the influence at that time, it's not an issue for CBP.
And Justin may be thinking, well, they're going to be lenient, right? I mean, they're not going to be heavy-handed. The laws are different in Canada than they are in the United States after October 17th. So, but in a conversation we had before this program a couple of weeks ago, one of the issues that came up with whether it's cases like this or, as we'll talk about in a moment, Canadian workers coming to the United States, people who work in medicinal cannabis as an industry traveling. There's not necessarily clarity or consistency, I guess, or maybe there is concern that different points of entry will have a different approach. Is that right?
Yeah, there are a few different grounds of inadmissibility that can apply to Canadian citizens, so it's important to keep separated the concerns related to Canadian citizens versus U.S. citizens. But in terms of U.S. citizens who are returning and have used personally, it's really just the possession issue and whether they're driving under the influence that are of major concern there.
I'm not asking you as an attorney to tell people at all that anyone would be lenient about this, but could you see a scenario where an agent at the border says, oh, you have some marijuana on you, and the person is saying, look, I totally forgot I still had that. I'm not bringing back in. I wasn't hiding it. You're saying absolutely not. Don't think they're going to be lenient. There.
No. If people have any amount on them in their vehicle, that's going to be a problem.
Okay. Don't expect leniency just because the laws in Canada are changing. And Jeremy, I know you see a lot of good of what Canada's doing, but when it comes to lack of clarity, which is something you just brought up, what is concern number one for you? And something we kind of talked about before the show, what's the worst case scenario when it comes to what's going to happen next with this new law change?
Well, I think the worst case scenario, at least from our perspective, does have to do with the ability of American and Canadian citizens to pass from one jurisdiction to the other. Operationally, I don't know that that Canada's adult use program really is concerning from from an industry perspective, meaning I'm not worried that people are going to be flocking across the borders to go acquire cannabis under Canada's laws, like you might see people go to Las Vegas where cannabis is legal for adult use, or Denver where cannabis is legal for adult use, because I do think that there will be a challenge flowing freely back and forth across the border. Now, do I think that this particular announcement by the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Division of the Department of Homeland Security is going to immediately lock down the borders and see that everybody traversing that border have their car tossed and be pulled out and be questioned at length about cannabis use or cannabis investments? I don't think that's going to happen. I think the risk is largely perception, but I do think that there could be some challenges with the freedom of people to move back and forth across the border, and to me that's the number one concern from this recent activity from the United States Department of Homeland Security as it relates to this October 17th transition in Canada.
Writing for Politico, Louisa Savage wrote a piece titled "Canadian Marijuana Users, Workers, and Investors Risk a Lifetime Border Ban," and I want to quote from Ms. Savage's piece now. Quote, "Canadians who work in the marijuana industry and those who invest in the booming pot sector risk a lifetime ban on travel to the United States, according to a senior official overseeing U.S. border operations. As Canada prepares to become the world's only major industrialized nation to legalize retail marijuana sales starting October 17th, the Canadian cannabis sector is projected to generate billions of dollars in revenue in coming years, and Canadians have flocked to take jobs and buy stocks in the burgeoning industry. But the move has potential to disrupt border crossings between the U.S. and Canada for travelers who run afoul of American drug laws, even if their activities are legal in Canada," end quote. Jeremy, I'll start with you. What do you make of that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what they're saying is they're expanding the scope of risk, so to speak. I'll call that the scope of risk, beyond simply individuals who may be driving back and forth across the border and who have either used cannabis in Canada or have acquired cannabis in Canada. That's one issue. What the Politico what the author of the Politico article is saying is that there is also a risk for folks who may be working in the industry, people who may be Americans who are working for Canadian cannabis companies, or Canadians who are working for American cannabis companies, or taking it even one step further, Canadian or Americans who have an investment in a Canadian or an American cannabis company. That, to me, that expands the risk pool, so to speak, beyond simply individuals who are driving back and forth across the border with or having just used cannabis.
Okay. Danielle, can you weigh in on that too, those questions outlined in Ms. Savage's piece?
Yeah, so there are a couple of different grounds of inadmissibility that could apply to Canadian citizens surrounding marijuana. One is the personal use, which we discussed. And the other category of inadmissibility grounds has to do with criminal-related grounds, which you have to keep in mind, marijuana is still illegal under U.S. federal law. So it is a controlled substance. Even if it's legal in the state where it's being used or taken to, it is even in those states, it's still legal under federal law. So the grounds of inadmissibility that could be applied in these situations involve there's a ground that applies to people who are convicted of or admit to having committed acts that constitute the essential elements of a violation of a controlled substances law. So I have seen cases where someone was a Canadian citizen was attempting to enter the United States, and currently it's still illegal under Canadian federal law to use marijuana without a prescription. And so an individual was asked by CBP if they had ever used marijuana, and they marched them through the essential elements of a controlled substance violation under Canadian law. The person answered honestly and admitted to all those elements. And even though they had never been convicted of any offense, they were still found to be inadmissible on that criminal ground because they admitted to the essential elements of it. So that's an issue. And going forward after the 17th of October, it's not clear how that ground is going to be applied because, if somebody says, it's October 18th and says, yes, I used marijuana this morning for the first time, then that's clearly not illegal under Canadian law. But if they say I used it 2 days ago before it became legal, they could still potentially be found inadmissible because it was illegal at the time that they used it. And we don't know how that will be applied. And then there's also another criminal-related ground, which is trafficking of controlled substances. And that ground of inadmissibility can be applied to people whom the officer has reason to believe is a trafficker in a controlled substance. So it's not necessarily, again, somebody who's actually been convicted of an offense, but they just have to have reason to believe it, which is a relatively low threshold.
Yeah, that seems like there's a lot of leeway there.
There is. And trafficking is a pretty broad concept. According to Black's Law Dictionary, trafficking is carrying out an illegal commercial activity. So, again, prior to October 17th, anything related to the sale of marijuana that's not legal under Canadian law or any activity that has a link to U.S. marijuana industry, which could be applied extremely broadly. If you think about it, there's the industry that's directly involved in handling marijuana, but then there's also a very large support network that's surrounding that industry. So that could involve somebody, a company that manufactures equipment that's sold to growers. That could be anything that's used in the production of the plants. And there have been some stories, I have not been directly involved in them, but there have been some stories in the press of people who are in those support industries being refused entry to the United States as a trafficker because they're tangentially related to the industry.
Wow. Before I grab Keith's phone call, yeah, Jeremy, I want to turn back to you for some thoughts on that. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that she's Danielle's drawing the critical distinction in the industry between touching the plant and not touching the plant. Or do you make what the old minor 49ers in California thought of as picks and shovels? Do you make grow lights? Do you sell potting soil? Do you sell vehicles used for transportation? Those don't involve directly touching the cannabis plant, processing, selling, growing the cannabis plant. And so the notion that people from, say, Scott's Miracle-Gro who make potting soil could all of a sudden run afoul of these guidelines, and I'll call them guidelines because I do think that they are just illustrative of the unclarity that you see. We've seen recently a political candidate, a candidate for elected office in Florida, have a bank account denied to her because she took funds from companies that support medical cannabis. Well, she's not touching the plant, and then you see an announcement from Los Angeles, the police department out there that has jurisdiction over LAX, the airport out there, saying we are not going to stop people who are carrying cannabis on flights that are going to other states where cannabis is legal. This is going to be up to the TSA. And then you look at the Transportation Security Administration's numbers from 2015 and 2016 in Denver, Colorado, and how many people they arrested for carrying cannabis onto planes. You know what that number was? It was zero. So this is just illustrative of this unclarity from the highest levels of federal government, our Congress, over how we're going to treat cannabis in the United States.
Is that a fair critique, Danielle?
There is definitely a lack of clarity. It would be really helpful to those of us who are advising Canadian citizens on this issue to have a clear policy statement from the federal government as to how they will apply these grounds. But
No. See, you're going to stay in business forever because of the lack of clarity. It benefits attorneys. You will never be out of work.
But at this time, I would not advise any Canadian citizen to file an application to enter the United States to work in any job that's remotely related to the industry.
Wow.
So there may be, for example, under NAFTA, which no longer exists, but if the immigration provisions from that permit engineers and engineering technicians who are Canadian citizens and Mexican citizens to enter the United States to work for a U.S. company. And there are people in the industry that would qualify to come in on a TN, but I think they would be opening themselves up to an incredible amount of personal risk if they were to pursue an application like that.
Let me get Keith's phone call first. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, how are you doing today?
Good.
It's kind of quite ironic. I just came back from Denver last night. I was there for 5 days, and it's not what people think. It's not marijuana isn't all over the place. There are some places that are restricted. I went into one, and the guy wanted to see my medical card, and I said, "No, I'm just a tourist." He goes, "No, can't sell it to you." Not that I was going to buy anything. Because each town or city gets to determine who gets it. But in Denver, it is recreationally sold. So we went in, and I saw the hours of operation of this place was, I think, 8 o'clock in the morning till 5:55. And I said, "Why do you have such odd hours?" And he goes, "Well, they basically want to close at 6 o'clock because they have families, et cetera." He said they don't want to stay open in the evening because they don't want to deal with drunks who want to get high. And I said, "Well, let's say if I wanted to buy some marijuana for a party or something." He goes, "People find a way to come in during the daytime. You don't see people." We went to a ball game, and I saw more people drunk at this Rockies game than I saw people smoking marijuana. I didn't see anybody near there, didn't smell it. I did a couple times walking down 16th Street, which is like one of the main drags of Denver. Somebody would be standing in the corner. But marijuana, at least in Denver, and I'm assuming all of Colorado, can only be used in your home. Smoking it outside is sort of like an open container law. But they do allow it. People look the other way. A cop's not going to hassle you if you're standing in the corner of a hotel outside next to an ashtray smoking a joint. They're not going to bother you. But then it leads to the whole question is, okay, what about somebody from New York State wants to buy some and bring it back? And they say, "Well, then your state laws apply." And when we were getting on the airplane yesterday, they had a sniffer dog.
You heard Danielle say, "Don't lie to them when they ask you."
Well, there was a sniffer dog sniffing everybody, but I didn't know if they were sniffing for bombs or marijuana. And it was laughable because, you know, I walked in and out just out of curiosity to see what was going on. And the dog was fine with me. But there was an elderly lady with a backpack. And if this guy didn't restrain the dog, he would have knocked her down. He was so aggressive. And I'm thinking, is she bringing something back for her grandkids or what? So they took her into a room. That was the last I saw of her. No, I don't know if it was, you know, what it was. I didn't want to ask. But they don't, you know, your luggage, you checked your luggage. Okay, it goes. And then your backpack, they did not look through my backpack. The scanner went through.
But I don't know if this is a perfect analog for border crossings, is it? I mean, what's your biggest worry here?
Well, what's going to happen is, are they going to do the same thing like TSA does? Are they going to set up these things where they have sniffer machines to see if you have it? Are they going to have dogs check everybody when they come across? Or what are they going to do? I've come across in Lewiston where they had dogs walk by cars, but those were bomb-sniffing dogs. So, but what are they going to do? Or are you going to get certain Border Patrol guys are just going to look the other way because they don't want to deal with the paperwork and the BS?
Well, let me turn over to Councilor Rizzo for that. Thank you, Keith. Go ahead, Danielle.
They do have drug-sniffing dogs at the border, and they'll take them out between the cars. And if a dog hits on a car, you know, they smell something, the car will be searched for something in there. And they don't have them 100% of the time out there, but they do walk them around, and that's being done now.
Can we stress again that you think it's a very bad idea to expect any leniency or, hey, bring it back, go to Canada, buy some marijuana, you'll probably be able to bring it back, they'll look the other way?
Don't do it. It's no.
Okay. Before I get Andrew in Rochester, Jeremy, you want to weigh in on anything that you heard there?
No, I was just going to, I agree. It's not, you know, being caught for a very small amount of cannabis, meaning that, you know, that whatever that amount is, a personal consumption amount, is simply not worth the downside or the risk of being interfered with as you cross the border. It's just not worth it. So I'm very supportive of that. I don't think that the likelihood is strong. You know, the takeaway from all of this inconsistency in federal treatment is that what happens is the decision to go through your car to find cannabis or to ask you questions about your cannabis use or your ownership of cannabis businesses or to enforce the law if cannabis is found on you or if you give an incriminating response, if there's no guidance from senior management, and by that I mean the federal government, the policymakers that make these decisions at the federal government, the Congress, then that role is devolved to that one guy or that one gal who happens to be working the border crossing, or that one person who happens to be working the TSA, or that one FDIC banking examiner who comes into the bank in Colorado that happens to be banking a cannabis-related business. You're devolving that discretion to that person because they don't have guidance. They don't have policy guidance from the decision makers above. And that's really the rub here.
Okay.
That's exactly right. And the border officers have an incredible amount of power. If they refuse somebody entry to the United States at the land border crossings, at least, they also have the authority to do an expedited removal. There are two legal grounds for doing an expedited removal. One is if somebody commits fraud, which shouldn't happen in this context, but could arise if somebody lies about their drug use. And the other ground is INA 212A7, which is failure to prove that you qualify for admission, which is also incredibly broad. And what expedited removal is it's a deportation proceeding that occurs right at the port of entry. There is no judicial review. It says right in the statute that no judge has jurisdiction to review these decisions. They are made at the port, and foreign nationals who are subject to an expedited removal are barred from seeking reentry to the United States for a 5-year period. That could be applied. These drug-related grounds of inadmissibility can amount to a lifetime bar as well. So that's one person that's making these discretionary decisions that can affect the entire course of people's lives.
All right, Andrew in Rochester, you're next on the phone. We've got to get our only break of the hour. We'll come back. We'll get Andrew's call. I've got a couple of emails from listeners who are wondering about how, and I think Jeremy Unruh can help us with this. He's one of our guests. He's on the line with us. He's the Directory of Regulatory Affairs for PharmaCann LLC. And I have a listener who's wondering about how Canada legalizing marijuana nationwide in Canada, October 17th, how that could impact the cannabis industry in the United States, either with the confusion of these laws or how Jeremy sees it impacting sort of the employment, the money side, the industry side. So we'll talk about that with Jeremy coming up here. Daniel Rizzo's in studio with us, a senior counsel with Harris Beach, who is going to be very busy with this, I think. So let's get that only break of the hour, and we're going to come back to your questions next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, another edition of Rochester's Fashion Week is coming. We'll talk fashion and also some of the beneficiaries, including LGBTQ youth who are at risk in our city. In the second hour, Michael Crocker joins us. He's the new executive director of Unshackle Upstate, the self-described pro-business organization, and he's a former aide to Congressman Chris Collins. We'll talk to Crocker Tuesday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Andrew in Rochester is next on the phone. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, great show, great timely show. Hey, I just want to make a comment, and you're talking about Canada becoming legal and then all the states around us, like Vermont, Massachusetts. In January, I visited friends who live in California in the first week in January, and while there, literally that week is when you could go into a marijuana store and buy marijuana. So for fun, we went to the store, and well, I'm 57, and no adult life. People that I've known, me included, have always thought, why is marijuana so, you know, people smoke marijuana are treated like little kids. So now in these states, okay, now it seems like they're being treated like adults. If you can go buy wine and booze and Jack Daniels in a store, why can't you buy marijuana? So the first time I went in a store, I thought, wow, this is what it feels like to actually be treated as adults. And then two more comments. I was in the Navy a long time ago. When I was in the Navy, I was on a ship of 300 guys for 4 years. And talk about an alcohol problem. Over 4 years, I saw hundreds of guys get arrested, broken noses, thrown in jail, all from drinking. I never seen anybody get in trouble with marijuana. And then another comment on that. I'm a deadhead. I used to go to a lot of Grateful Dead concerts. You go to an 80,000-seat stadium like Rick Stadium. A lot of people smoking pot. I never seen a fight, anybody swearing, carrying on. Saints Stadium, Buffalo Bills. You go there any Sunday, thousands of people drunk out of their mind, leaving that parking lot drunk, screaming profanity, fighting everywhere. I've always thought, what's the deal? How come marijuana users are treated like kids and alcoholics are treated like adults? It's really strange. And the last thing is my friends of mine who come from California to visit here, when they go to the airport, they bring small amounts with them, and they've told me that TSA has seen pot in their luggage, just small amounts, and they don't do anything about it. But anyhow, I think we're going in the right direction, and I think it's always showing how phony America is, where you got one drug, you go to the store and get Jack Daniels, and but you can't smoke pot, where, as far as I know, nobody's even died from, and people, the most they want to do is maybe buy pizza. But those are my comments, and it's...
Yeah. Yeah. Look, Andrew's not wrong to say that our drug law is very arbitrary, that alcohol is a drug, caffeine is a drug. I would say I'm addicted, but it's legal to be addicted to caffeine. And I take the point that you're making, Andrew, and maybe what you say when you think it's going in a good direction is you think we are moving in the direction of legalization. You also say there's another story of TSA looking the other way. Again, Daniel Rizzo, don't look to the analog of the TSA thinking, well, if you're crossing the border, if you're traveling, don't assume law enforcement will ignore laws is probably a good piece of legal advice.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, we're just going to keep saying that. But Jeremy, how do you feel about what you heard from Andrew there?
Well, Andrew makes a lot. He knowingly or unknowingly wraps up a whole lot of issues in his comments. You know, we have decades of cannabis culture here in the United States that goes back to the, you know, the early 20th century, and part of the reason why cannabis use is suspect is because there was a lot of work done by some of the early drug czars in the United States to paint cannabis, which was associated with Mexican immigrants and with, you know, African-American jazz musicians in New Orleans and other, you know, it wasn't what, you know, back in the pre and post prohibition days, wealthy white people drank martinis and drank old fashions. They didn't use cannabis. They didn't use marijuana, which that term marijuana is actually an old slang term. So there's a lot of culture here that we're just in the last 5 to 10 years rewriting and changing people's impressions. You know, when you look at New York's program, it's very, very highly regulated. It's not the Western style of medical cannabis where you see people forking cannabis out of mason jars into a little baggie and handing it to a person who is quote unquote a patient and calling that medicine. You go to our dispensaries in the eastern United States in New York, and those dispensaries are managed by pharmacists, and those you have to have one of very serious medical conditions to go into our dispensaries. And so there's a lot of culture that's changing here, and I think that when people see that Canada can develop and roll out a responsible, harm-reductive adult use legalization scheme and generate tax revenue as a result and make sure that public health risks are known
and identified and then managed, I think that's going to help. That's going to help people get comfortable with the notion of doing it here in the United States. You know, when you look at the data, you know, the Journal of the American Medical Association and other Journal of Public Health have identified that there are reduced death rates from opioid and heroin overdose in states with medical marijuana laws, and in states with adult use laws, traffic fatalities have gone down and domestic violence has gone down, and largely that is associated with the reduction in binge drinking in those states. So like I said, Andrew has wrapped up a lot of different issues in his comments.
Well, I'm just going to tell, and Andrew, I'm just going to share a brief story that I guarantee you, if I was retaining Danielle Rizzo as counsel, she would advise me as her client not to tell the story, but I'm going to do it. Here's the brief story. I bet you this was 10 years ago, and I was anchoring morning news for WHAM-TV here in Rochester. And the truth is, there are some mornings where you can't pre-read every story that you read on the news if you're a news anchor. Hopefully you do all of that and you rewrite all of that. But sometimes there's crazy stuff happening and you don't. Usually, we call that cold reading. If I'm cold reading a story on the air, it's usually in the entertainment block, which I don't think is impactful. So I'm cold reading a story on the air, and it starts with this. The idyllic image of Marianne from Gilligan's Island has been shattered. And I'm thinking, oh no, she killed somebody. The 60-something-year-old actress was found with a small bag of marijuana in the backseat of her car in L.A. And so we get done with the story, and it comes back to a two-shot of me and the anchor, Holly Maynard, at the time. And I turned to Holly, and I just said, it's not like it was hard drugs. And she looked at me, and she looked at the camera and said, we'll be right back. And the phone just kept ringing with people who said, Evan Dawson, how dare you? One drug is another drug. It's all the same. And they're all evil. And I had to make phone calls saying, yes, I know, it's terrible. And I'm somebody who's like, how many times have I smoked marijuana in my life? Twice? Three? I mean, it's just not really working for me. But I don't really care about it personally. But yeah, people get really fired up, Andrew. Some people really get fired up. So it's interesting to see where public opinion is going anyway. And can we confirm, Councilor Rizzo, that you would have told me not to tell that story on the air? It's borderline.
You know, as a U.S. citizen, it's not going to affect your border crossing.
Yeah, there you go. That's where you come in. Now, on the subject of what is changing, again, if you're just joining us, October 17th, Canada is legalizing marijuana recreationally with some restrictions. And by the way, I think this is a helpful email that I just got from about where you're going to be able to get it. Jessica writes to us and says, cannabis will only be sold through mail order in Ontario, not in stores under the Ford provincial government. So it will not be possible for Americans or anyone to go to a store and buy it in Ontario. You'll have to have an Ontario address. So I guess the Ford provincial government is taking its own tack on that. I've got a few other emails, but let me get Adam's email asking for Jeremy Unruh, who, again, Jeremy is Director of Regulatory Affairs for PharmaCann LLC. Adam wants to know, can Jeremy compare New York State to other states that you work in that allow medicinal marijuana in terms of how tight regulations are? And Jeremy, that's not exactly related to what's going on in Canada, but I do think it's an interesting question from Adam. How do you view New York State versus others? And I ask that reminding our listeners that over the last few years, when this state rolled out medical marijuana, the governor was very, very hesitant to get on board at all. He has called marijuana a gateway drug many times, despite evidence to the contrary. And there's significant restrictions on how you can ingest it, et cetera. So how do you view it in New York versus other states?
Yeah, so I think over the past six months to a year, the governor's position has evolved, and I don't know if that was because of his challenge from more liberal Cynthia Nixon, or if it was really his identification of what's happened over the last 3 years or so in New York's own medical marijuana program. But what I can tell you is there's an Eastern style and there's a Western style of regulatory scheme in the medical cannabis world, and the Eastern style is far far more rigidly regulated than the Western style. And that comes from, you know, the first laws in the United States, medical marijuana laws, arose out of California and Oakland, the Bay Area, and they basically legitimized existing black market activity. Okay, so you've got 10 plants in your garage, you can give it away to friends and family. And then the next iteration was, well, maybe you can sell it, but you can only sell it as a non-for-profit. You know, and so that's how those programs are reflective of where those laws developed from, where they evolved from. In the eastern United States, I would say kind of Illinois and eastward, the programs were developed by lawmakers who got out a piece of paper and started to just write laws and pass those laws. And so the industry was built in accordance with those laws from scratch. We didn't evolve an old legacy mom-and-pop industry into the 21st century in New York. And so New York's program looks very much like the Department of Health, who administers our program in New York, how they want it to look. And the folks in the Department of Health are pharmacists by trade and public health administrators. And so what we see in New York is a highly restricted but true medical focus of the cannabis program. And so it sets a standard for true medical cannabis schemes in the way that it operates. We don't sell dried flower, the green grassy substance most of us recognize as cannabis. Everything in New York, for the most part, has to be extracted into an oil and then formulated into a finished product like a vapor pen, like a vapor pen that you'd inhale.
Should that change?
A capsule.
Do you think that ought to change, Jeremy?
I think it will change. Mm-hmm. I think it's in the process of changing right now. Why? Because dried flower is the cheapest to purchase if you're a patient or a consumer in an adult use scheme. It's the most easy for us to produce. It's the cheapest for us to produce, and it's the most versatile for patients or end users. If patients want to go home and safely and responsibly extract the oil and make brownies or make other edibles, they can do that. If they'd like to vaporize dried flower, they can vaporize it. That doesn't require them to inhale the smoked portion of it, or they can smoke it as people traditionally do. So I do think that those are evolutions, and I think we'll see that as New York continues down the adult use conversation, which is very, very, very relevant in New York right now.
All right, let me get an email from Steve. He says, hi, Evan. I'm a process engineer working on several Canadian capital projects related to extracting and purifying cannabis compounds for distribution and use in Canada. I will have to go to the client's site to program and commission the equipment. I will not be handling cannabis directly. What risks will I face when re-entering the United States? That's from Steve. Danielle Rizzo.
Okay, so he didn't mention in the email whether he's a citizen of Canada or the United States.
I assume he's a United States citizen.
Okay. So that if you have any concerns about going into Canada, those are concerns that I really can't address. I do U.S. immigration law, so we're talking about the consequences for Canadian citizens who are seeking entry to the United States. And this is from a non-Canadian immigration attorney, keep in mind, but my understanding is that once it's legalized in Canada, if there are any consequences for U.S. citizens, it would be more related to trafficking grounds, and I really can't speak to the scope of what that entails under Canadian law.
Okay, Jeremy, do you think there's reason for Steve, who is an engineer, to be concerned? An American engineer goes to Canada to work on Canadian capital projects, doesn't handle cannabis directly. Are you worried about folks like that?
I think that his profile falls within the scope of the Politico piece you talked about earlier. I his work is ancillary to the cannabis space, but I'm a former prosecutor myself. I'm a lawyer by training too, and I could easily formulate a line of questioning that would elicit what I think is incriminating responses from him if he were crossing the border. So, yeah, I think there is a theoretical risk that he could be challenged. Do I think there's a real risk, or do I think that risk is really viable? I don't, particularly if he doesn't have any cannabis with him, if he doesn't, you know, if he doesn't volunteer information about his work as a process engineer. I mean, you're a process engineer. Process engineers do a whole lot. I'm sure that companies like Honeywell and Boeing have, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of process engineers. And
sure.
I think you can be truthful while not being incriminating as you go across the border under the circumstances that were given in that email.
All right, down to our last minute or so. Daniel Rizzo is a senior counsel with Harris Beach. What do you expect this law to do the most for your workload? What kind of cases do you think you're working on? About 30 seconds. What do you think?
I think I'm going to get a lot more inquiries from people who are concerned about what's going to happen to them when they cross the border. I've already been getting cold calls from people who are in the cannabis industry asking about what this means for them. And I also think I'm going to be getting calls from Canadian citizens who have already run into problems where they've been found inadmissible due to admission to drug use.
Mm. And Jeremy Unruh, who is Director of Regulatory Affairs for PharmaCann LLC, about 30 seconds. What do you see as the economic impact of what's about to happen in Canada on October 17th?
Well, I think that Canadians will have a fairly immediate impact because they're going to start generating tax revenues from those adult use sales. I think the impact in the United States is that we citizens are going to be seeing a successful, responsible, harm reductive adult use strategy actually functioning and working in Canada. And we're going to look at ourselves and say, well, why can't we do this here?
We will see. That'll be very interesting. October 17th is the day that Canada rolls out their nationwide legalization, not medicinal, but for recreational cannabis. Thanks to Jeremy Unruh for joining us. Appreciate your expertise and insight this hour. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you. I appreciate being there.
You got it. And Daniel Rizzo is a senior counsel with Harris Beach, who came in from Buffalo. You got Rochester offices, though, right?
We do. Yeah, we're headquartered in Rochester.
Rochester, Buffalo office. Thanks for making the trip in and for sharing your expertise as well.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
All right. Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Send all your angry emails to me, and I will talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.